Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Hospice News Elevate podcast. I'm Holly Vossel, Senior Reporter for Hospice News and Palliative Care News. In this episode, we'll be discussing the largest concerns topping the minds of clinical leaders in the hospice space and the successful strategies they're employing to address them. With us today is Holly Davis, Clinical Operations Manager of Atrium Health Hospice and Palliative Care's Community-Based Palliative Care Program. Davis serves as Chair of the National Alliance for Care at Home's Pediatric Workgroup and is a member of its Hospice and Palliative Care Councils. She is also the Pediatric Division Chair for the National Coalition for Hospice and Palliative Care. Additionally, she leads a community-based palliative care team providing care to adult and pediatric populations across the greater Charlotte, North Carolina area. Davis completed her bachelor's degree in the science of nursing at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte in 2001, later receiving a master's degree in the science of palliative nursing at Damon College in 2007. She has 24 years of experience providing hospice and palliative care to terminally and seriously ill patients of all ages, as well as their families. Throughout her nursing career, Davis has participated in the implementation of the concurrent care for children provision across multiple states. Mandated as part of the state Medicaid and children's health insurance programs, Davis has helped integrate the pediatric hospice provision in Florida, Hawaii, Maryland, North Carolina, Tennessee, and Virginia. Right. Well, hello, Holly. Thanks so much for joining our talk today. All right. So, Holly, why don't you tell us more about Atrium Health Hospice and Palliative Care's community-based palliative care program and your role as clinical operations manager?
Absolutely. So, I am based in the greater Charlotte market right here in Charlotte, North Carolina. And my community-based palliative care program serves seven counties in that area, Mecklenburg, Cabarrus, Stanley, Union, Anson, Iredale, and Rowan County. And we provide palliative care support to patients and families in their home, as well as in assisted living and skilled nursing facilities. And our palliative care program is made up of nurses, social work, and advanced practice nurses, nurse practitioners. And we're going out to see patients in their homes to work with their families on advanced care planning, goals of care discussion, and managing pain and symptoms that arise related to that chronic medical condition.
Thank you for that introduction and that kind of overview of everything. I think as we're, our topic today is really going to be talking about some of the things that, you know, top the minds of clinical leaders today in the hospice space. So I think one of the biggest questions that I have for you right off the bat is really, what do you think are some of those pressing issues or challenges that hospice clinical leaders have on their radar today? What are they facing?
Well, Holly, they're facing quite a bit of challenges, actually. So some of the more pressing things that are top of mind that I think anybody who is doing any sort of operations in hospice and palliative care these days are really looking at workforce and staffing. There's been lots of new rules and regulations that come along with that. Reimbursement, the auditing climate that's out there related to some of the changes with regulations. And then more recently, the telehealth flexibilities, you know, going back to workforce and staffing, not only are we looking at vacancies or open positions, but the pool in which you have an appropriate or well-trained candidate can be very narrow or slim in the areas just based on where you're trying to serve. And so workforce is something that is top of mind for us at even a national level as we talk about how we prepare for those entering the workforce and those looking to make that transition into hospice and palliative care.
And I think workforce topics have really come to the surface a lot, not just in recent years with being exacerbated by the pandemic, those shortages, right, in healthcare, but just overall, even before that. So I think that's why I had this question for you about keys to, you know, hospice clinician retention, in just ways that you can really keep those valuable staff once you get them in your doors.
Absolutely. So I've been in a leadership role for a number of years, and I can remember back when I started in my first leadership role, if I had a vacant position, I could put that position out there and you would get lots of applicants. And now it can take much longer to get applicant, and the candidate pool looks very different. The experience that they're coming with looks very different. How well they're prepared. I actually was having a conversation today about staff post pandemic. I remember hiring a nursing assistant to come into the hospice house, and she did her training during the pandemic. And at that time, this hospice aide and a lot of the programs out there were doing training in the clinic or in SIMS labs. They weren't actually dealing with real patients. And so they were doing all of that interaction with other CNA students or a mannequin in the bed, learning how to do bed baths. And so when she was hired and came on board, now as a hospice organization, I have to fill in those gaps that the training was missing. So how do you interact with patients and families? How do you present yourself? How do you, because that's very different than when you're dealing with a mannequin, right? That mannequin's not talking back to you. They're not having all of that facial expressions. They're not necessarily in pain. So you don't realize when you go to turn them what that looks like. And so the challenge of the types of candidates and applicants and how our universities and training programs are producing the next generation really kind of has impacted the organization. So I can say from that standpoint, our normal hospice orientation was not ready for that type of applicant or candidate to fill the position. We were accustomed to at least them having some experience in the real world, right? Interacting with patients and families. And that was not necessarily the case with that particular situation. And so it required now the hospice palliative care organization to build that in or to at least acknowledge or accept that this was a possibility that their hands-on real-life experiences might look very different because of the pandemic and that sort of thing. I think also your very seasoned staff and some of your maybe even not-so-seasoned staff decided to get out of the medical field altogether based on the pandemic and took other roles, really kind of changed, if you will, or exacerbated a shortage, a workforce shortage that was already going to be happening. You know, when you think about like retention, you know, when you have that really good employee, you want to love them up, right? Love them up or you lose them. And I think that that's really important when you have high performers that you're always re-recruiting them. You always want to make sure that they stay. And so what's important to that particular teammate or that particular employee, how can you ensure that the role that they occupy stays in their good favors, like so that they want to stay in that role? And that kind of shifted, you know, because there's not always another candidate right behind them waiting to take that position anymore.
Right. And I think that these are very important, you know, challenges that have kind of endured, right? So as you're looking from and hearing things from both your new hires and your existing hospice clinicians, you know, what are they telling you as far as some of their, you know, most important and leading priorities, you know, reasons that they choose to stay with your organization?
Well, I think immediately most people gravitate towards or think of compensation. And competitive compensation is definitely a priority, but I can't say that it is always the number one. I think that it's usually in the top is to have competitive compensation. And so making sure that your organization is constantly looking at the market. I know during COVID, staying up to date with a competitive compensation package was hard at times. The market changed frequently. It's stabilized somewhat a little bit. It's not changing as rapidly as it was back in 2020. But the market is really important to kind of know where compensations are. But I would say more importantly, people stay because they're satisfied with that role. And so what does job satisfaction look like to each employee is important, whether that means that they feel connected to the purpose of the work, that they feel that they are doing good, or that they feel of value, or that they're involved in the clinical practices or some of the decisions of the organization, I think is really important. A lot of employers do employee satisfaction surveys, which are great. It gives you a pulse, gives you an idea of what your teammates and your workforce is thinking. But I always feel, Holly, honestly, if you're going to do a survey, what's really more important is that you do the action behind that survey. Because I think that that sends a very clear message in that the leadership of the organization is really vested in your satisfaction. And so if you do a survey and your teammates tell you that they're not happy with the start time of the day or whatever it is that they're not happy with, and then if leadership doesn't take that into consideration, then I think that that can have a negative impact. So doing a teammate survey, you really want to follow that up with an action plan. Making sure that benefits and time off, that kind of goes hand in hand with your competitive compensation package. But I think I hear a lot from my teammates and from others is that they want flexibility. And flexibility can look very different to each teammate. Sometimes flexibility means that they need to be able to run an errand in the middle of the day. And sometimes that flexibility means that they want to work a 10-hour or a 12-hour day versus the traditional 8-hour day. Maybe that means that they want to start at 10 o'clock instead of 8 a.m. And so being able to build in some flexibilities is really important as well to retain those top-level clinicians.
I've heard things on that same wavelength as flexibility and scheduling is also like balance of, you know, their caseloads and their patient, their workloads, right? Yeah. Having the ability to do it all right. And make sure that they're not burning themselves out. Yeah.
Right. And that's a lot of challenge for organizations.
It can be, right? Especially if you're trying to grow your census, but also, you know, grow your team. It's always that balance, I think, for organizations too, which is why I had that question for you. As far as some of the ways that hospices are kind of addressing all those priorities you just mentioned among their clinical teams specifically. So what are you seeing as some of the ways to address these priorities and put those sort of action plans into place that you were mentioning once you get the feedback as far as their priorities?
Well, I think all of us are challenged, and maybe not unique to just hospice and palliative care. I think overall, all of us are challenged to do more, and maybe we don't have the workforce to do all that. So I hate the saying, do more with less, but it's kind of how can you build in efficiencies And so really investing in technologies has helped gain some efficiencies, whether that's the utilization of artificial intelligence to help with documentation. You know, is there a way with predictive analytics to help the clinician work smarter, not harder? How can we be efficient? What kind of things can be automated? So I think that AI and predictive analytics has really helped hospices and other healthcare specialties gain some of those efficiencies to be able to do more. We at Atrium Health have unit-based councils, and these are made up of clinicians in the field at bedside. Those that are doing it every day, all day long, have really good and great ideas and can really kind of help you shape best practices. And it also helps the frontline staff really understand the why behind what you're doing. Example, recently, as in 13 days ago, or 14 days, on October 1st, new hospice quality initiative tool rolled out, our HOPE tool. And that really required changing, if you will, or adapting some of the way in which the hospice clinicians make visits or answered questions as they're visiting patients with their symptom follow-up visits or their hospice update visits and that sort of thing. And so having that unit-based council really kind of look at that and understand what are these measures looking for, how can we best capture that, and understanding the why versus them feeling that things are always happening to them. And so I think that helps involve them in the day-to-day practices as well. Back to that regular market analysis of compensation is really important. If they know that you are valued as a teammate and that you're being proactive and you're looking at that as your annual enrollment comes up for benefits, making sure that you have benefit packages that are helping support the teammates and their families. And so looking at those premium costs and how that can be offset by the companies or your 401ks, again, going back to that employee satisfaction in those surveys, making sure that you're always constantly getting their input and having regular check-ins with them. And I think something that can tend to get overlooked by organization is leadership development. I think all of us can think back to times where we've had a leader that was really great that we've reported to, and then we've had leaders that are not so great that we've reported to. And I think that spending the time to invest in leaders, in helping retain your workforce, is really important. So you can't stress enough that leadership development is important as well as you're looking at ways to address these priorities.
Yeah, just having that leadership development and engagement, you know, investing in those leaders that want to be the leaders and giving them an avenue for it, and to feel supported by those leaders if you're, you know, someone just stepping into hospice and learning. And I think that's another question to revisit too, which is the recruitment side of things. And just kind of circling back to some of the things that you were mentioning, you want to revisit that. How has your hospice found, you know, is the biggest challenges when it comes to clinical recruitment? And then what are the ways you're kind of navigating those challenges and addressing them?
I think, you know, one of the challenges with recruitment is, a few years ago, you could put a job posting up on your organization's website and applicants were coming to you. And now recruiters are having to go to the applicant. And so it's always trying to find where are those applicants, what boards are they looking for, is Indeed the right spot, is ZipRecruiter the right spot, is this other platform the right spot? Or LinkedIn, is that the right spot? And so where you find those qualified applicants has changed a lot. And so I've heard from my recruiting partners within multiple organizations that they're having to go and find those applicants that are qualified for the position. And so that's been more time consuming, whereas in the past, you could just post a position and people were coming to you. I think also being creative and having detailed within your posting. Recently, I had an open position, and that position was in our South Mecklenburg area. But the listing did not specify South Mecklenburg. And so in speaking with the recruiter, we added a little bit more detail into that posting. And we did that on a Friday. And come Tuesday morning, we had 5-6 new applicants to that position. And so I think being able to specify more in detail what the job entails and the position entails, sometimes more than what that job description may describe, is helpful. One of the things that Atrium has recently adopted is we're also putting in the pay grade and the compensation rate for those positions. And so that can be a double-edged sword. There's lots of opinions about what that looks like, but that is something that is in there. And from a hiring manager standpoint, that has really helped me be able to answer some questions as applicants are asking about pay grades and job ranges. It's actually taking some of the onus of salary and compensation off of me because it's on those job postings now.
I think that transparency is something that they're seeking, right? Any job applicant is seeking. So when you're transparent about things like your salary or, you know, that kind of thing, and you're mentioning that, that really does kind of hit to applicants, okay, this is what to expect, right? There's enough in hospice that can come that as a surprise. Once you're in the role, you know, it's a different experience. So I think just being very transparent is something that I've heard a lot of hospice leaders say is key in that recruitment bucket, and the retention for that matter, is having an organizational culture that's transparent and engaging, to your points that you brought up so far. So we've talked a lot about some of these known challenges. Let's explore some of the things that might be kind of under the radar among clinical teams that leaders might need greater insight into. So what would you say is some of the under the radar challenges among hospice clinical teams that leaders could have a better pulse on?
I think some of the under the radar things that people may not recognize, and this, I'm going to shift to my pediatric background and viewpoint from this. So I think, you know, from a societal standpoint, from an outside looking into hospice and palliative care, one probably assumes that it's primarily adult-based patient population. And there are children in the United States that need services, need hospice and palliative care services. And during the pandemic, a lot of organizations got out of providing that much needed service to our pediatric patients. And I think that what we are finding is that there's lots of gaps across the United States for access to pediatric hospice and palliative care services. There's children who want to go home, their families want to take them home, but there's not a community-based provider that's willing to accept them. And that landscape has really changed a lot post-COVID, and we are continuing to battle that. And so I think that being able to have equitable access to pediatric services across the U.S. is important. The other thing that usually falls under the radar is that pediatrics typically is a Medicaid reimbursed service where the adult side of the house, the majority of your hospice patients are Medicare patients. With pediatrics, it's Medicaid. Medicaid is a state by state. And so each state has a little bit different kind of availability of services. They might have a little bit different availability of resources. And so that really impacts what types of care kids can have, and sometimes even within the same states. Example might mean that we provide, and there might be a provider for pediatric hospice and palliative care services in Mecklenburg County, for example, but if you go three counties away, there might not be a provider, even though they're both counties are in North Carolina, there might not be a provider. And in some states, there might not even be a provider within the state limits. And so I have heard of children and families moving out of states to go to other states and or even other counties so they could get access to the care that they need for their child. And so I think that that's something that falls under the radar of a challenge. But with my pediatric kind of perspective, that is definitely something that keeps me up at night and keeps a lot of our pediatric colleagues up at night is access. And then having well-educated and trained workforce, I think, is something that we need to look at. We need to kind of look at our hospice onboarding, our palliative care onboarding and orientation. A lot of job descriptions that you might look at from different organizations require experience, a certain number of years of experience, say. And so is it possible to develop mentorships within an organization? What would that lift look like for organizations if you were to take someone straight out of school, whether that's your CNA, whether that's your new graduate nurse or your new nurse practitioner? What kind of support does that need? And that type of clinician, brand new into the field, is going to need different supports from someone that is seasoned. And then there's been a recent term that I've heard talked a lot about at a national level, which is that primary palliative care. And so we know that there's not enough board-certified palliative care physicians and board-certified nurse practitioners and certified hospice and palliative care nurses. We know that there's not enough of those out there. And so how do we provide training and education to all healthcare professionals so that they know how to start those conversations, those difficult conversations about what are those goals? What really are the options? And what do we want to have happen as disease progresses? And so I think those quality of life conversations are really important. And so these are just a few of the things that I feel go under the radar that we may not see on a day-to-day basis.
But I think that they kind of speak to the things that are on other, you know, hospice providers' minds and keep them up at night as well. I've heard it kind of echoed, you know, the concerns regarding pediatric access, but and not just to those underserved patient populations, but others, right? Some of the challenges that are coming around. And to your point, having that kind of pool of talented individuals, maybe they don't have, you know, a certain number of years of experience, but they might have the interest in that field or, you know, just need that greater exposure, which is something I think is kind of percolated to the top of issues and challenges of recruitment is that, you know, a lot of those medical students don't get a ton of access or exposure to hospice and palliative care training. So, I think that's why I saved the best question for last as far as ways that you can engage that next generation of hospice clinical leaders. What are some ideas that come to mind as far as getting stronger engagement of that next generation?
Well, I think what you said about exposure is important. I think that, again, when I'm out in the community and people say, Holly, what do you do? And I tell them I'm a hospice nurse. they say, oh, how sad. Or, and then if I tell them that I work with pediatric patients, then, you know, I really get a response of that has to be so difficult and hard. And to me, I've been doing this work for almost 25 years now. And it has brought so much joy in learning and fulfillment. And I've learned so much from our patients and families and the impact that hospice and palliative care has had on me is beyond words. And so I think having clinicians exposed to that, whether that's in their schooling or their training or opting them to have an elective, some sort of interaction exposure, whether that's through volunteer work or they're coming into a hospice house and sitting with patients or rounding with a clinician. I think just that exposure so that they can see the fulfillment. I will tell you, though, in old hospice nurse myself would say is that if anytime I'm hiring a new person that's brand new to hospice or palliative care, I always kind of say that first year is really going to be the telltale sign. Either they're going to love it or they're not. And if they love it in that first year, they're going to know. And if they love it, they'll never be able to do anything else but hospice and palliative care. And if they don't, I think they leave the specialty with a greater appreciation for life and a greater appreciation for the work that is done and have a new passion and appreciation for that. But it's definitely something that becomes interwoven into the hospice and palliative care clinicians. It's not a job to do for a paycheck. It's definitely a calling. And I think that you learn that definitely within that first year as working in hospice and palliative care. So I think greater exposure, understanding really help engage the next generation.
Well, thank you so much again, Holly.
Absolutely. Thank you, Holly.
Well, that wraps up this Elevate podcast. Just a quick note before we sign off that our Hospice News podcasts are possible thanks to those in the field willing to share their insights. Let us know if you or others are interested in participating or sponsoring an upcoming podcast episode by reaching out to us at editor@hospicenews.com. Once again, I'm Holly Vossel, Senior Reporter for Hospice News, a WTWH media company. Thanks for listening to today's Elevate podcast, and stay tuned for more episodes. Take care for now.